Song of Liberty by Smetana. The Prague Radio Chorus was conducted by Milan Marley. Well, that's it for this morning. I'm so glad that you're able to join me. Next week, my string serenade is by Tchaikovsky, the exuberant full-string version of his sextet Souvenir de Florence. And my central theme from 10 will be film music, from Max Steiner to Shostakovich, from Victor Young to Robert Farnon, and much else in between. So do join me if you can. Same time, 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 this week, with studio production by Neil Miners.
For 2013 on Radio 3, the story behind one of opera's greatest composers, with performances of every one of his surviving operas. On BBC Radio 3, Verdi 200. I Lombardi with Ramon Vargas and Erwin Srott. Tomorrow night at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Stephen Tomkinson is one of our best-loved actors. One thinks of television programmes like Drop the Dead Donkey, Bally Kiss Angel, Wild at Heart, DCI Banks, the film Brassed Off. And now, Stephen, I imagine you must be having a lot of fun in your debut as King Arthur in Spamalot on the West End.
Yes, and now for something completely different, as Monty Python would say in their own inimitable fashion. Yes, delighted to be involved in the production, a production that I saw originally on Broadway and then when it transferred here to London to the Palace Theatre. And it was then, when Eric Idle presented it, a very big Broadway musical show. And we've sort of scaled it down. It's a new production directed by Chris Luscombe, and in many ways we've kind of reclaimed it for a British audience, and it's now much more in a review style, which I guess the original Pythons would have done, you know, a lot of quick changes and silly voices, and we make various topical references to people in the media at the moment, and the audience are a lot more involved, so it's much more of a shared experience now.
Was the Python entourage an important part of your life when you were young?
Very much. You know, I was one of those kids in the playground mimicking the sketches that I'd seen the night before, and when the Monty Python and the Holy Grail film came out, I was straight down to the pictures with my brother and my two cousins, and oh, I must have seen it countless times since then, and played it to my daughter when she was 6, and she absolutely loved it. And now that she's 12, and when I said, you know, they're interested in me being King Arthur in Spamalot, she just said, "Oh, Papa, I'd be so proud." So that was the icing on the cake, and that's how the deal was sealed.
It's interesting that we relate so well to kind of surreal humour.
Yes, yes, very much, because it's so untraditional. It suddenly becomes very personally yours when you understand it. And they were such great performers and writers, so there's no room to embellish at all. There's a very strict discipline to it. And the momentum that builds throughout the 2 hours of the show is, it's beautifully crafted, and a joy when the audience get involved and you take them on the journey with. It's a fantastic shared experience.
I mentioned Brassed Off because that's such an obvious connection with music.
Yes.
And it must have been a very touching film to make, I imagine, especially given your closeness to Pete Postlethwaite.
Yes, I was lucky enough to work with Pete first on my first ever TV series and an Alan Plater scripted show called Tales of Sherwood Forest. And Pete was amazingly generous with his time and taught me to appreciate more than anything that the script was everything. And when the script came through for Brassed Off and had the opportunity to play Pete's son in a story about the mine closures, which was very close to my heart when I first came to drama school in 1984. There were still, you know, miners on the street with the coal not dole stickers, and we invited two of them in to speak to us and let us know what their struggle was all about. So this film came along, written by Mark Herman, and it was a wonderful, beautiful and true story about the Grimethorpe Colliery Band, who won the national championships 2 days after their pit was closed. We sort of extended the period to say it was 2 weeks after in the film, because we didn't think anyone would believe us. And then we all met as a cast and got to meet the Grimethorpe Colliery Band themselves for the first time at Abbey Road Studios, which was a very powerful and emotive meeting, because, you know, the history involved in that studio, and to see Pete again. And then we sat down and listened to the band play and to record for the first time. And it was, yeah, I think there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
And I think the flugelhorn is something you particularly were struck by.
Yes, and Mark Herman had written in the script that when the character of Gloria, played by Tara Fitzgerald, makes her first impact on this male-orientated world of the band, she does it with an amazing solo played on the flugelhorn. And the piece that Mark chose was Rodrigo's Guitar Concerto. He'd asked for permission from Rodrigo's widow, and she'd said no, we couldn't use that piece. Her husband had written it and intended it for the guitar only. So what Mark did was send the piece recorded by the band at Abbey Road and wrote to her in Spanish, which I thought was a very clever touch. And when she heard the band's rendition of that, she did give permission. And I'm not surprised, because Paul Hughes, who was one of the miners who did the solo, is every bit as intricate as the guitar playing, and it's an amazing piece of music.
It might be worth mentioning for people that don't know exactly what the flugelhorn is, that it's like a slightly more mellifluous trumpet, isn't it?
Yes, it's a sort of few tones lower, and
it has a slightly more round, warmer sound, used a lot in jazz, of course.
Yes, but the intricacy that these boys can get out of with their triple tonguing, it's quite astonishing and hard to explain, but a joy to the ear.
Thank you. Actually, hearing that music with the flugelhorn gives it a slightly Morricone spaghetti western feel.
Yes, yeah,
it?
There is, it does. There's a sort of inherent Spanish feel to it. It's art brought back some lovely memories, that.
But as you say, the solo flugelhorn beautifully played there by Paul Hughes with the Grimethorpe Colliery Band, directed by John Anderson. And that was in Aranjuez con tu amor from the Concierto de Aranjuez by Rodrigo, arranged there by that fine film composer Trevor Jones. Stephen Tomkinson, you were brought up in North Yorkshire, and it sounds as though you had a stable and rather happy childhood.
Yes, very much so, in Stockton-on-Tees, where I was born. And Dad had four brothers and a sister, and my mum had two sisters and a brother. But first of all, my dad's eldest brother had married my mum's eldest sister. So two brothers and two sisters had married, and we were a very close family. And a lot of gatherings round the piano at Christmas, and a lot of listening to great tenors like John McCormack, and listening to a lot of classical music when I was a child. I suppose, typically being a child, the one that really appealed to me was the Nutcracker, especially at Christmas when there'd be the family gatherings. I think it's the most beautiful ballet. And just a dream for a child, to be whisked away to the land of sweets. It doesn't get any better than that. And the sort of second half of the ballet is then like a glorious cabaret turn, where, you know, each different dance is performed. And I remember going to see it for the first time at the Opera House in Blackpool, and there was a sort of school's matinee, and all the kids joining in with a particular tune that was identified with a chocolate bar narrated by Frank Muir.
Yeah.
But there's so many other highlights in the whole piece. But I think my favourite was the closing of the first half and this magical transportation away to the land of sweets. It's
a dream come true. Ability to do that, didn't he, Tchaikovsky?
Definitely.
Yeah. So this is the forest of the fir trees in winter, the waltz of the snowflakes.
Thank you. Thank you.
brings it all back?
Oh, completely. It transports you utterly. It's just fantastic.
It has got an extraordinarily sort of Christmas feel.
Very much. Very much. And that's, you know, something that never leaves you.
That was the second tableau from Act One of Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker. And we heard the orchestra at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Mark Ermler, with the Halesworth Middle School Choir, directed by Christopher Barnett. Another work which was designed to Stephen Tomkinson specifically with children in mind, and works an absolute treat. There is too, and what children always like, an element of real danger.
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember being terrified by the noise of the wolf from Peter and the Wolf. I mean, but as you say, it's a beautiful introduction to the orchestra, and each animal being represented by a specific instrument and a specific section of the orchestra. And the emotions it takes you through, or certainly did to me as a child, have never left me. And I always thought that, you know, Peter's first introduction and walk out into this magical place on his own is something that I'll never forget and always keep with me whenever I'm outdoors.
I suppose for you too, as an actor, this is a wonderful combination of drama and music.
Yes, very much, because, you know, you have the narration and Peter is your hero at the middle, so you put yourself in his shoes. And
How early on did you sort of get the bug to act?
I don't know specifically. I mean, I had a... everyone talks about the wonderful one teacher that showed you the alternative to your school books, and it was a teacher called Jeff Lynham, who I did plays with him from the age of 11 to 16. So I guess at some point during there I actually sort of toyed with the idea of doing this for a living. But it was just a toying with the idea at the time. There was no real history of it in the family.
But it is extraordinary. I can't tell you how many times on this programme, and it's such a lesson to the world, people like you who are very distinguished in what they do, somebody turned the lock of the door, somebody had the key, and it was usually a teacher who had a particular enthusiasm and a way of communicating that love of whatever it was.
Yes, and fortunately, you know, having the support of my parents as well, that could see that, you know, I was all consumed by this and very serious, and they supported me all the way.
I'm sure you'd love to narrate Peter and the Wolf one day.
Yes, well, I did get the chance to do it at a concert by Canary Wharf a few years ago, which was an open air thing and free. It was beautiful, and lots of parents brought their children and just let them run around in this grass area, and to see how they were interpreting each piece of music through movement themselves. And then they all sat down when the wolf came on and went back to Mum and Dad. It was delightful.
Well, we don't have you, Stephen, but we do have Sting.
Ah, well, a fellow Northeasterner, Mr. Sumner, and a great teacher as well.
Let me tell you a story. This is the story of Peter and the Wolf. It's a musical story where the characters are represented by different instruments of the orchestra. For example, the bird is represented by the flute. The duck by the oboe. The cat by the clarinet. The grandfather by the bassoon. The horns. And the hero of our story, Peter, is represented by all of the strings. The Hunters by the Woodwinds. Hunter's Rifles by the Timpani. Early one morning, Peter opened the gate and went out into the big green meadow.
You can see that it's instantly compelling, can't you? Because every little motif has a kind of lyrical memory that sort
Definitely.
Of is triggered.
Yeah, and as I said, just the perfect introduction to the orchestra for any child.
We heard the opening of Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, conducted by Claudio Abbado, and Sting was narrating. Now, having just heard about the wolf, I think this is a very good moment to mention more animals and, of course, very considerable time you spent making Wild at Heart in Africa.
Yes, we had 8 trips out there, the first 7 being, you know, when we were doing the full series, so I got to spend 5.5 months at a time with these amazing four-legged creatures. And we've just completed filming a 2-hour special this year that will be on between Christmas and New Year, where we finally get to say goodbye to Leopard's Den, which was very hard, but all good things must come to an end. And it was a real treat to be out there and see these incredible creatures in the environment where they're supposed to be and how these incredible sizes and camouflages do work in that vista. You can be 30 yards away from an elephant and not realise until it moves.
But sometimes that can get these creatures into trouble, because I think you had a very close relationship with a certain giraffe.
Yes, Hamley, who was an absolute delight and a real one-off. He was fascinated by people and, of course, by the amount of people and equipment that a film crew brings with it. And he used to appear at my dressing room, which had a balcony on the first floor, just to have the top of his head scratched every day. And the relationship got so close that when I was lucky enough to be made executive producer, I suggested a storyline where my character Danny was lost in the wilderness being pursued by a wild dog and was going to be saved by a giraffe, because I convinced them that I could get Hamley to stay with me for long enough, and even when the character passed out, he stood over me even when they landed a helicopter beside. And but yes, and then tragically last year he was struck by lightning during a storm,
I wonder if you're more kind of liable to be struck by lightning if you're that tall.
It is, yes, a bit of an unfortunate accident, yeah. And
but
it sort
did
of
he
goes
also
with the
get
territory.
Stuck in the swimming pool?
That was his sister.
Oh, right.
Yeah, who went for a drink at the swimming pool and toppled over. It's one of those things that you don't hear on many other film sets of there's a giraffe fallen in the swimming pool.
And they had to really dig the end of the pool out.
We did, yeah, because Lucy was pregnant at the time, and we were worried that if she tried to get out, she may damage herself and the baby in some way. So the best thing to do was get a big digger in and pull out one side of the swimming pool, and then she was able to walk out as if nothing had happened.
Now, we heard Sting just now, Stephen Tompkinson, and the Sting is slightly behind the motivation of this piece.
That's true. I was really taken with the movie when it came out. It was about 1974, I think, so I'd have been nine. And I thought the intricacies of the plot and the amazing chemistry that Robert Redford and Paul Newman had, it was, you know, a worthy Oscar-winning Best Picture winner. And somehow the setting of Scott Joplin's music, which came from a slightly earlier era. I suppose Ragtime was about 1912 and the film was set sometime later. I think Marvin Hamlisch orchestrated the pieces, and it just made it so evocative. And particularly the piece that I've chosen, entitled Solace. It was sort of a shot set at 2 o'clock in the morning. There was no one around, and Robert Redford just leaning against a lamppost and the skyline. It was just perfect.
Thank you.
They often have that slight bittersweet melancholy to them, don't they?
Yes, and it's the simplicity of just that one instrument is amazing.
Solace, a Mexican serenade by Scott Joplin, played by his great interpreter, Joshua Rifkin. We like to embrace on this programme, Stephen Tomkinson, whenever possible, all the appropriate passions. And apart from music, I think cricket is one of yours.
Cricket's a huge passion, yes. The whole family used to get involved in that. We lived in Scarborough for a few years, and Dad used to play village cricket and go all around what's now termed as Heriot Country. So there were some idyllic fields and sort of endless summers, really. And I suppose the piece of music that used to get me so excited as a boy, if I ever heard it emanating from the TV, was Booker T and the MG's Soul Limbo, which used to be the BBC cricket theme.
Yes, and it immediately said cricket after a while. So kind of association, yes.
I think that sort of West Indian element and just endless sunshine, I suppose.
Was Booker T and the MGs with Soul Limbo. You couldn't make a first-class cricket team, Stephen, but one of the aspirations which you could make one day, I guess, I read somewhere, was to be a baddie in a James Bond film.
Oh, yes. Who wouldn't? It's why it's such a successful franchise, I think. People like the same formula being shown again and again, and you know, you get these regenerations. Daniel Craig's doing such a wonderful job at the moment, but I'm sure there's many more illustrious actors in the queue ahead of me.
Well, I don't know. I think with your King Arthur moustache and beard,
well, yes,
I can see it.
It works well on radio.
Anyway, let's talk a little bit about the next piece of music, and I think brings us to the subject of religion. And I imagine the religion you probably encountered as a child was of a very different sensibility to the one that Mozart suggests in this next music.
Yes. You know, I think your image as a child of hell is sort of Wagnerian and fire and brimstone and torment. And somehow Mozart's take on it was, there may be other reasons why people get sent to hell. There could be mitigating circumstances. And he has such beautiful sympathy for the people therein, and this music was just sort of made me think a different way, I suppose, and that's Mozart's genius.
Well, of course, it's all the more touching because it came right at the end of his life, when he must have known he didn't have an awful lot, long time to live.
Yeah.
And even the words in Latin are rather beautiful, aren't they? Lacrimosa. Suggests tears.
Yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it just gives you pause for thought.
The Lacrimosa from the Requiem in D minor, Kirkel 626, by Mozart. The John Alders Choir and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Has jazz been something that's important to you, Stephen?
Well, I think sort of the person who just sums up jazz to me, the first time that I heard him and saw him was Louis Armstrong. He was like a living cartoon. And this amazing sound that he could create, not only from his trumpet, from his throat as well. And he just used to fill me with joy whenever I saw him or heard him. And, you know, you take an amazing film like The Philadelphia Story and then you remake it as High Society and you stick Bing Crosby in there as well and Frank Sinatra. And Cole Porter. It's just an irresistible combination. And again, going back to sort of Peter and the Wolf being a great introduction to the orchestra for children, I think anyone listening to Now You Has Jazz as an introduction and for Louis to introduce the band that he played with as well. And the combination of him and Bing Crosby sort of just messing about at the end. You can almost hear Bing Crosby corpsing at one point. So it's such is the joy that it evokes.
Dear gentle folk of Newport, or maybe I should say hats and cats, I want you to lend an ear because, I want you to hear some really shimmering sharps and flats. For these cozy virtuosi, just about the greatest in the trade, are fixing to show you now precisely how, or approximately, jazz music is made. Well, you take some skins, jazz begins. And you take a bass. Man, now we're getting someplace. Take a box, one that rocks. Take a blue horn, New Orleans bar. Ah, you take a stick with a lick and take a bone. Oh, hold the phone. Take a spot, cool and hot. Now you have jazz, 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 jazz. A little danseur. That's positively therapeutic. Now you have jazz, 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 Messrs. Hall and Young. That's Ed Hall. And Trumia. Now you has Messrs. Kyle and Shaw. That's Billy Kyle. Arville Shaw. Now you has Mr. Barrett Deems. Listen to, well, you know who. Hey, Pops, you want to grab a little of what's left here?
Yeah, Daddy, yeah.
Here we go. If you sail,
I sail in, sailing
over the sea.
Or will you wait for me?
Take my tip, they're all moldo hip in Italy.
Or will Averaduce ask for France?
Oh, I know you're very big there.
Yes, believe it or not.
I do believe, I do indeed.
The Frenchman's all prefer what they call les jazz high.
Fool me down, take a plane.
Oh, Baba do Zat.
Go to Siam.
Baba.
In Bangkok today, round the clock, well, they all like to jam.
The
Indians on
oh,
the Amazon.
Oh,
beat one bar and all of them are.
Oh, well, gone, man, gone.
From the equator up to the pole. Everybody winging, everybody singing that rock, 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 rock and roll. From the east to the west. From the coast to the coast, jazz is king, jazz is the thing the folks dig most. Now that's jazz.
It has a wonderful joie de vivre.
Oh, absolutely. It's impossible to hear that and not break into a smile.
Now you has jazz from the 1956 film High Society. The lyrics, of course, and song by Cole Porter, Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong we heard singing there. Just going right back to one of your first projects, Stephen. Of course, you don't know what I'm going to say next. But I think this was a very important moment for you because you studied The Crucible, didn't you, by Arthur Miller?
That's right.
When you did it, your mum saw it and realised this was something you could do seriously.
Yes, the original plan, sort of quite wisely, as I said before, with there being no history of acting in the family, was that I would go to university and read either English or drama and at least have a degree to fall back on if I wanted to go to drama school after that. But I was doing theatre studies, A-level, at the time, and The Crucible was on the syllabus. And another drama teacher, Stephen Brennan, who I'll always be terribly grateful to, decided to put the play on as well and cast me in the role as John Proctor, which is the first real serious part that I'd done. And yes, Mum and Dad came to see that and decided on the strength of that to abandon the idea of university and go straight for audition into drama school.
And how right they were. Well, wish you a great deal of luck as you continue in the Playhouse, I think it is.
At the Playhouse Theatre, yes.
Yes, with Spamalot. I must say, I look forward to seeing it.
Oh, I hope you do come along. Thank you.
Stephen Tomkinson was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the Nobel Prize-winning Turkish author Orhan Pamuk. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
Intune is back for 2013, and we're starting the year with a bang, a special edition of the programme live from Salford with the BBC Philharmonic. The composer and broadcaster Howard Goodall will be joining me ahead of his BBC Two series, The Story of Music, and the orchestra will be playing new works from young musicians in and around Manchester. A special edition of In Tune, tomorrow afternoon at 4:30.
Well, the early music show is coming up after the news in a moment, and then at 2:00, another chance to hear a concert from last year's prom season. It's the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink, and a performance of Haydn's Symphony No. 104 and Strauss's Alpine Symphony. Choral Evensong is at 4:00, and then in the choir at 5:00, Anna Jones talks to the composer Alexander Lestrange about his African-inspired Zimba project. And he'll also be talking to the conductor Stephen Layton about his work with the choir at Trinity College, Cambridge. And that'll take us up to 6:30 and Words and Music, in which Geraldine James and Neil Pearson read poetry and prose on the theme of beginnings. The poetry is by Tennyson, Denise Levertov, Dylan Thomas, Tom Gunn, Sylvia Plath, Philip Larkin and A.E. Houseman. And there's music by Haydn, Cole Porter and Purcell. So that's Words of Music at 6:30. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1:00 and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, has made a defiant speech in which he called for Syrians to defend their country from what he called terrorists backed by foreign powers. Mr. Assad outlined a new peace initiative but said he would not engage in dialogue with criminals from outside Syria or puppets created by the West. Here, the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, called the speech hypocritical, saying the promises of reform fooled nobody. David Cameron has said voters will be offered a real choice about Britain's future relations with the European Union. He told the Andrew Marr programme on BBC One that Britain was entitled and enabled to request changes to its membership of the EU. Mr. Cameron also said ministers were considering whether or not they could deport the radical Muslim cleric Abu Qatada before he has exhausted his right to appeal in the UK. He was freed on bail in November when a court ruled that he might not get a fair trial if deported to Jordan to face terrorism charges. A report into hundreds of deaths at Stafford Hospital is expected to call for sweeping changes to the NHS. The Sunday Times and Sunday Telegraph say a public inquiry which examined the failings, which occurred between 2005 and 2009, will recommend a new management culture and better training. Indian and Pakistani troops have exchanged gunfire across the disputed border in Kashmir. One Pakistani soldier died. India's military denied Pakistani allegations that it crossed the line of control and attacked a Pakistani army post. Police investigating the discovery of a woman's body in a car in South London have charged a 30-year-old man with her murder. Jerome MacDonald from Croydon was arrested on Friday. English Heritage says it's planning to stop putting up blue plaques on buildings where famous people lived and worked. It says funding cuts of nearly 35% mean it can't afford to continue to pay for the scheme. And the weather, it'll be generally cloudy across much of the UK. Most places should stay dry, but through the afternoon, outbreaks of rain are likely to spread across Northern Ireland and parts of Scotland. BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one. And time now here on BBC Radio 3 to join Lucy Skeeping for today's edition of The Early Music Show.
Welcome to the show, and music from a concert given in Fontfroide Abbey near Narbonne in southern France. This beautiful former Cistercian monastery dates from the 11th century, and although it's been a long time since monks lived here, the place still has an extraordinary calm, spiritual atmosphere, mainly due to its loving restoration just over 100 years ago by two pioneering French artists who turned the site with its historic courtyard, Gothic cloisters, chapel, refectory and rose garden into a centre for arts projects. Last July, as part of the 2012 Fontfroide Festival of Music and History, one of the major figures in early music, the viol player Jordi Savall, directed a whole weekend of events there. Well, today we're going to hear highlights from one of those performances. The theme is Tudor England, a lively selection of songs and dance music for viols and lute, played by Savall's highly acclaimed ensemble, Hesperian 21. This is music from England's golden age, and some of the Tudor period's biggest names are featured. Anthony Holborn is the main contender, alongside John Dowland, William Byrd, Alfonso Ferrabosco and Christopher Tye. But before that, we're going to hear a dance by Clement Woodcock, a consort piece by our very musical monarch Henry VIII, and to start the set, a pavan and galliard by Innocento Alberti.